Manny. From the very beginning, it had been a turbulent relationship, a family of soon-to-be five crammed into a one-bedroom place, the girls sleeping in the family room, a heavily pregnant Juanita wedged into the lone bedroom with Hector. Tempers had been high, their major hobby, tequila, which had led to fights, then tears, followed by more fights and more tears. "We were both drinking too much," Hector said heavily. "It wasn't good. I know that now." "What happened?" Dee Dee asked. The big guy shrugged. He was wearing an open, red-checked flannel shirt over a stained blue T-shirt and jeans. It looked to Dee Dee like he'd just rolled from bed. If he was still working nights as a bartender, maybe he had. "Manny was born. Place got crowded. Less sleep. Juanita, she was angry all the time. Seemed like I couldn't do anything right. So I worked more. Drank more. Then, 5 years ago, I couldn't take it. We had a big fight. Juanita was screaming. The kids were screaming. I punched a wall. Put my fist right through it." Hector rubbed his knuckles as if in memory. "I knew I did wrong. I could see it on my boy's face. He was scared of me. I took off, just hit the stairs, kept running." Dee Dee waited. "I heard later, Juanita didn't take it well. Drank harder. There was some drama. Family services was called, but I'm not sure what happened. I left town and Manny doesn't remember much. But Juanita lost custody of the kids. She had to do court-ordered counseling, join AA. Then she got the kids back." "She lost the kids," Dee Dee interrupted. "Yes. Juanita blames me for the alcohol, for all her problems back then, which isn't fair. She was drinking way before she met me. But together, we were so loco. Apart is better for us. She is sober now, goes to AA every week. Manny says so. And me? I cleaned up my act, too. For Manny. He's my boy. Every Sunday I pick him up and it's our day together. Juanita and I, we might have the devil inside. But Manny, he's perfect. In every way. Perfecto." Dee Dee nodded. Her hand was still on Hector's arm. Now her grip relaxed, but she kept her gaze on his face, her voice level. "You're saying Juanita was an alcoholic when she met you, but now she's sober?"
"Yes."
"What about this new guy, Charlie Boyd?"
They met maybe a year ago. Juanita is a nurse at St. Elizabeth's. Charlie came in for stitches, had cut himself on the job."
"He's a contractor?"
"Yes."
"Do you like him? Get along?"
Hector shrugged.
"Manny likes him. He's helping Charlie work on this house, fix up the place, learn some skills. I like that. Maybe Manny will become a contractor, too. Better money than bartending."
"Sounds like Charlie spends a lot of time with your son."
Hector stiffened, but didn't take the bait.
"Charlie doesn't like me. Like I said, Juanita blames me for her drinking, so Charlie does, too. But I asked around. Charlie's not so perfect, either. At one time, he was a man who liked his beer. Manny, though, he says everything is good now. Charlie gave up drinking for Juanita, even goes with her to meetings sometimes. Life is calmer. Juanita, happier. That's good. I loved Juanita once. She is the mother of my son. I want her to be happy."
"And the girls?" Dee Dee asked. "Roxana and Lola? Who were their fathers?"
"I don't know. Juanita never talked about them.
One man, two separate fathers, different men, but not around. I told you, Juanita was a drinker before she ever met me."
"What can you tell us about the girls? Did they get along? Like Manny?"
"Roxana and Lola? Yes, of course. Manny is their baby brother. They love him. Maybe spoil him. It's not so bad that Juanita moved in with Charlie. Otherwise, poor Manny was being raised in a family of girls.
Roxy is 16.
Pretty?"
Hector shrugged.
"Sure," he said in a way Dee Dee took to mean he was being polite. "But, maybe not like her mother and sister. Juanita? Muy guapa. And Lola, her mother's daughter. Trouble, that one."
In other words, Dee Dee thought, Roxana was the ugly duckling of the family.
Interesting. "She into boys?"
"Roxana? No. Roxy's quiet, shy. She reads, takes her studies very seriously. When Juanita and I were living together, Roxy fed her siblings, got them dressed, then off to school, where there was also daycare for Manny. She took very good care of them."
"Roxy is the responsible one?"
"Yes."
"She have a job?"
"I don't think so. She's close to the dogs, maybe the one who takes them for walks. Blaze and Rosie? Manny loves those dogs. Charlie, he rescued them from some breeder. The kids, even before they liked Charlie, they loved his dogs. Roxy and Manny often take them for walks together. Manny says they are very good. When they were puppies, they were never allowed outside, so now they like to be on the back porch, lie in sunbeams. On walks, they trot right along. You'd never even know they were blind. The dogs spend most of their time outside? In good weather, yes. Dee Dee looked up at the brilliant blue sky, figured today qualified. And Lola? She asked. Hector hesitated. Lola is very pretty. Too pretty for 13. And fiery, like her mother. She doesn't take her schooling seriously, and she definitely likes boys. Manny says she and Juanita fight all the time. Things have not been easy lately. Manny mention any particular boy his mother and sister might have been fighting about? Manny's 9. He thinks his 13-year-old sister is silly. He doesn't pay much more attention than that. But Manny loves his sisters, and they love him. Hector smiled. His whole face softened, a jagged mark on his cheek becoming less menacing, more of a war wound. And Dee Dee's heart broke for what she'd have to tell the big guy next. Those girls, they would do anything for Manny. And he loves them, too. He's sweet, kind, not at all like me. Can I see him now? My son? I'm sorry, Mr. Avalos. He's at the hospital? I'm sorry, Mr. Avalos. Then she didn't have to say the rest. He knew. From the neighbors' reactions, the crime scene tape, the detectives who wouldn't let him inside the home. Or maybe a parent simply always knew. Felt it, like a light suddenly winking out. Hector's knees buckled. He went down, Dee Dee's hand upon his shoulder. She kept it there, while he hung his head and wept. Chapter 4. After my morning run, I showered, forever, then threw on a pair of old gray sweatpants and a rumpled white t-shirt from my favorite kickboxing gym. I padded into my tiny kitchen, stood, stared, tried to identify anything I could eat. My mother was a compulsive baker under stress. To this day, our time together remained awkward, her anxiously seeking my face for signs of fresh bruises, abrasions. Me trying to pretend that, no, I hadn't wandered the streets of Boston at 3 a.m., trying to blow off steam by baiting predators and picking fights. But at least when my mom came down from her farm in Maine, she brought me food and baked even more while she was here. According to my refrigerator, she hadn't visited in a bit. I should do something about that. Pick up the phone. Make the effort. Be the daughter she deserved. What my mother and I had in common was guilt. Guilt on her part that I'd been abducted, though it was hardly her fault. Guilt on my part that my kidnapping had put her through 472 days of hell, though that was hardly my fault. Jacob Ness. He did it. Hurt us both, and we hated him, vehemently. Which was the real problem. We both needed to let him go. Samuel told me that all the time. I would truly be over my trauma when I could go an hour, a day, a week, without even thinking of Jacob's name. I wasn't there yet. I gave up on food, poured a giant mug of coffee instead. Then I crossed the 3 feet from my kitchen to my family room, where I set myself up on the sofa, laptop balanced on my knees, coffee mug at the ready. Light streamed in from the bank of windows on my second-story apartment. I kept the windows covered in a light, gauzy material, enough to grant some kind of privacy in the midst of an urban area, while allowing sunlight to filter across the room. Needless to say, I still didn't do well in small, dark spaces. Such a bright, sunny Saturday morning. So many things normal people must do on a day like today. As for me, I booted up my laptop. I got to work. Because while I'd never sold my story to any of the producers or agents banging at my door, lately I had started sharing it, in little bits and pieces, to a select group of kindred spirits, other survivors like me, also trying to find their way. A year ago, I'd established a private chat room where we could meet, sometimes just to vent or support one another through a particularly bad day. but also where, from time to time, we shared more detailed posts from our own experiences. I hadn't known what I'd think of it. One, this attempt at mentoring others. Two, finally putting even small pieces of my story into words. And yet, these women I could talk to, these survivors got me, and it did help make a difference. I took a deep breath, then began. My victim advocate, Samuel, says the key to this survivor business isn't to tell yourself the world is safe, or to try to convince yourself you have nothing to fear. The world is plenty dangerous, and we all should be a little scared. The antidote to anxiety is strength, to remind yourself that you did survive the first time. You made the right decisions, you took the right actions, even if that really meant taking no action at all. You survived, and no one, not even dead and yet still somehow present Jacob Ness, can take that away from me. If only I could truly believe. Returning home after my abduction, I didn't wake up in the middle of the night remembering that I was tough, or dreaming about the second, third, or hundredth time I convinced Jacob not to kill me. I suffered terrible nightmares involving coffin-sized boxes, giant alligators, and Jacob's hands closing around my throat. I had to turn on every light in my childhood bedroom. I had to study the pattern of my bedspread. I had to work on deep breaths in, slow breaths out. I enrolled in the first self-defense class following a particularly bad night, a night when every time I closed my eyes, I spun away from the safety of my mother's house and ended up trapped in Jacob's big rig all over again. If the antidote to terror is strength, then I had to find some muscle, because I couldn't take many more nights like that one. I wouldn't say I was a natural at hand-to-hand combat. I was underweight, sleep-deprived, a bundle of strung-out nerves. But the instructor gave me focus. Hit the dummy! That simple? That complicated? First time stepping up to the plate, I really wanted to beat the shit out of that oversized Ken doll, knock the smug smile right off his mannequin face. The more I tried, however, the more I failed, which simply made me want to try harder. If I could get my hand properly fisted, if I could get that fist to connect with dummy Ken's head, then maybe I wouldn't be so scared anymore. Maybe I would finally sleep at night. It took me 4 classes. While I started eating more of my mom's carefully prepared meals and took to running up and down the stairs in the house because I still couldn't go outside or jog along rural roads, and not just because of my own terror, but because of my mother's fears. Then, the moment I finally managed to slug Ken, solid connection, felt it radiate all the way up my arm from knuckles to wrist to shoulder. I cried. I hit some practice dummy, and I broke down. I bawled and wept all over the blue exercise mat, sniffling, wiping my eyes, smearing snot across the back of my hand. The instructor didn't say anything, just stood Ken back up and ordered me to go again. I found something in those classes, a small but savage beast just waiting to be let out of its cage. Truth is, I survived, Jacob. But I never fought him. On the beach when he abducted me, I don't even remember that night. Maybe I was that drunk. Maybe he ambushed me that cleanly. I don't know. My first memory is waking up alone in a coffin-sized box where I made like horror movie bait and screamed and screamed. Nothing happened. No one magically showed up, set me free. I beat my hands against the locked lid. I bloodied my heels against the wooden floor. Nothing. I don't even know how long Jacob let me stew in there, long enough without food and water that by the time he finally appeared, I didn't launch myself at him like a rabid animal. I didn't go for his eyes or his throat or his balls. I wept in gratitude. I held up my bleeding fingers to him in total, complete supplication. These are the things you can't get out of your head later. These are the comments that still kill me to read on social media now. Why didn't I struggle harder? Why didn't I work my hands free from the bindings when he left me tied up in motel rooms? Why didn't I bolt from his big rig the first time he pulled into a truck stop? Why didn't I do something, anything more? Why didn't I fight? I don't have those answers. I never will. Samuel says this is the biggest burden all survivors bear, the coulda, woulda, shouldas. In his opinion, it misses the point. I did escape from Jacob Ness. I did survive. To second-guess my actions now is just plain stupid. And yet, night after night after night. I took the first self-defense class, hoping to ease my night terrors. Then I took the firearms class, because beating a life-size Ken doll wasn't enough. Watching videos on how to pick locks and escape from various wrist restraints? Well, what else is a girl going to do when she still can't close her eyes at night? I'm not saying I have all the answers yet, but I've learned to make it through. To find my way to some new kind of normal, where I'm not the person I used to be, but I'm not the victim Jacob tried to train me to be. Maybe this will help you. Maybe not. If there's one thing I've learned these past few years, it's that there's not one right way to deal with trauma. Each of you will have to find your own tricks, just like I did. And some days will be so impossible you'll wonder how you can go on. On those days, I hope you'll remember this post. I hope you'll reach out to us here. You are not alone. The world is filled with survivors. And we are all just trying to find the light. I stopped typing, reread the words, wondered what the others would think, especially Sarah, when they read this part. I positioned my hands on the keyboard again, gave up. I rose from the sofa and padded toward the kitchen for more coffee. It was now after 10. Late morning, my mother would call it. She was generally up by 4. Me too, but not for the same reasons. I poured more coffee into the mug, added cream and sugar. I moved on from feeble promises to call my mother and considered reaching out to Stacy Summers instead. She was the college student I'd rescued last year. We kept in touch. I told her I'd be there for her after that awful night, and I didn't lie. I'd assumed at the time that would mean me counseling her, but instead, watching her progress? Stacy had leapt forward after her trauma. She'd turned toward her parents, not away. She'd reached for her faith instead of my Bible of self-defense. She'd listened to everything I had to say, then done it all one better. She should be writing a memoir, not me. She wasn't just a survivor. As the saying went, she was a thriver. Me, on the other hand, I remained a work in progress, a kidnapping survivor who lived in a one-bedroom apartment where the walls were covered in accounts of other missing persons cases. Again, Stacy had her faith in God, I had my determination never to be weak again, as I liked to tell the group, whatever worked for you. I left the kitchen, turned on the news. The first thing I saw was the red stripe streaming across the bottom. Amber alert. Missing female teen. I steeled myself, as I always did when taking in such news. A new case. A fresh outrage. I wasn't a shell-shocked, fresh-out-of-the-hospital kidnapping victim anymore. After the events of last year, surely I'd earned the right to call myself a professional. But then I saw the name of the missing girl. Roxana Baez. I nearly dropped my mug of coffee. Sarah, I thought, and I knew, beyond a doubt, that it had all started again. Chapter 5. Do we know who placed the initial 911 call? Dee Dee asked Phil after Hector Alvalos had departed. The infamous Mrs. Sanchez, who also notified Hector of the shooting. 2 uniformed officers already touched base. She said she was standing in a kitchen making breakfast when she heard what sounded like gunshots. She was just talking herself out of it when she heard a bunch more. She picked up the phone and called. Where does she live? Across the street. Before you ask, her kitchen is in the rear of the apartment, so she says she couldn't see anything. Mm-hmm. Dee Dee was already suspicious. Any other calls come in to 911 around this time? 2 more. All right, let's identify those neighbors, separate them out from the herd for further questioning, including Mrs. Sanchez. I want to know exactly what they heard and saw, or maybe didn't see, so we can build a timeline of events. Detective Manley, have any luck with the vets? Yes. Phil flipped through his spiral notebook. A Dr. Joe, who has a clinic near St. Elizabeth's. According to her records, both dogs are up to date on their shots and vaccines. Boyd didn't have them chipped, as, given their age and eyesight, they're not known for roaming. Sweet dogs, she says, shy and noise-sensitive. Rosie's the leader of the two. She only lost her eyesight recently. Blaze is in the habit of following her, so if something spooked Rosie, say, gunfire, she would bolt. Blaze would follow. How would blind dogs run away? Dee Dee asked. I mean, how can they tell where to run to? Apparently on their own turf you'd never know they were sight-challenged. Assuming the kids took the dogs for walks in the neighborhood, they'd follow a trail they already knew. Front gate would have to be open for them to escape the yard, however. Dee Dee eyed the fence lining the rear of the property. Old and weathered, it was a good 6 feet tall and filled with solid wood slats, no doubt built for privacy. Two elderly Brittany Spaniels would never be able to clear it, no matter how startled. In contrast, the chain-link fence encircling the sides and front of the tiny house was only waist-high, probably installed by Charlie Boyd just for the dogs. Again, she doubted two old spaniels could jump it, but the front gate didn't have a lock. If it had been left ajar by the shooter on his way up to the front door... She wondered how Alex and Jack were doing with their mission. Were they, even now, proud owners of a puppy? Would it prefer lounging on the back porch on sunny days? Or would it be content hanging out in the house, say, eating Dee Dee's considerable collection of shoes? "I'm thinking shooter came in the front door," Phil was saying. Walked straight into the family room, took out Charlie Boyd first, 3 shots to the chest. Dee Dee nodded. Given the position of Charlie Boyd's body, that made sense. Poor guy had never even made it off the sofa. One second he'd been watching TV, and the next... "Shooter walks in through the front gate," she concurred with Phil. "Doesn't bother to close it behind him or her." "Because this is all going to be quick," Phil agreed. "Front door of the home is unlocked, or someone let the shooter in?" "Unknown. In this neighborhood, most people probably do keep their doors locked. But a sunny Saturday morning, maybe Roxy had just left with the dogs." "TBD," Dee Dee agreed. And an important to be determined, as the lack of forced entry, combined with Charlie's seated position on the sofa, implied the shooter had walked right into the residence. A friend or family member strolling casually in the family room? "Hey, Charlie." She had many questions for the neighbors gathered on the street. But for now, she continued, "After Charlie's shot..." Shooter heads into the kitchen, takes out Juanita Baez, who's in the middle of unloading groceries, and is just now having one of those, "Did I hear what I think I heard?" moments when boom, 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 she's down too. "Leaves two targets," Dee Dee said softly. Phil sighed heavily. Father of four, married to his high school sweetheart, these kinds of cases took their toll. Clearly, Lola and Manny have enough time to process what's happening and move past denial. Baby brother runs to his big sister's room. They try to hide. "Doesn't work," Dee Dee murmured, then frowned. "Shooter doesn't have to go upstairs. In this scenario, the kids haven't seen anything. Shooter could continue straight out the back door, cleaner escape, bigger lead time before the cops arrive. Maybe one of the kids was on the stairs, saw something, then the shooter had no choice but to chase after." "Or heard something," Dee Dee tried out. "Say, Roxana's voice, talking to her co-conspirator? Assuming she had help." In situations where the teenage daughter is in on the murder of her family, the girl rarely acts alone. There's a druggy boyfriend. Mom and Dad hate him, but he's the only one who ever understood her. Or a sadistic friend saying she's got to do equally evil things just to prove she belongs. Or maybe there were drugs in the house. Dee Dee shrugged. The friends knew and wanted them, hence taking out the parents, then Roxy's siblings when they saw or heard too much. At this point, all we have is Hector Alvalos's impressions of Roxana Baez, and for the past 5 years, he hasn't even been part of the family. Kids hide enough from the parents they live with. It would be nothing for Roxy to keep Hector in the dark. "She doesn't have a social media footprint," Phil said. "What?" "No Instagram, no Snapchat, no Twitter, no Hangout apps." "Lola Baez, yes, but we can't find any evidence of a social media life for Roxy." Dee Dee frowned. "That's not normal." "To add to the puzzle, I just did a quick check. The computer browser was cleared 2 a.m. last night, and substantial amounts of the hard drive wiped. So while we are seeing internet postings from Lola Baez, the only activity is from first thing this morning." "Someone's trying to cover their tracks." Dee Dee looked at Phil. Most likely, Roxana Baez, whose lack of social media accounts indicates a certain level of paranoia right there. She took it one step further. Something happened in the middle of Friday night that was serious enough that Roxana did her best to delete all traces of computer memory. And then, what? First thing this morning, she works on erasing her entire family? Who is this girl? Phil could only shrug.
We're beyond my detective-grade tech savvy. Computer geeks will have to take it from here.
Dee Dee sighed heavily. Nothing against the tech geeks, who were brilliant, but more experts meant more time, the one resource they didn't have right now.
Any other devices we should know about?
Dee Dee asked. Dee Dee and Phil had recently attended a class on home electronics and how they could be used to assist in a murder investigation. From the digital water meter that showed a guy using hundreds of gallons of water at 3 in the morning, helping to prove the prosecutor's argument that he was hosing blood off his back patio, to so-called smart appliances, such as refrigerators, Amazon's Echo device, etc., etc., which recorded short periods of time throughout the day. Homeowners had placed themselves under more voluntary surveillance than most understood. Basically, that snapshot the smart fridge took to help you figure out what fruit to buy might also include a view of your ex-husband's dead body, which you'd planned on burying later in the day with the shovel Alexa had ordered for you from Amazon. Every time Dee Dee thought her job couldn't get any weirder, it did.
Nothing too high-tech, Phil reported. Just the smartphones, 2 home computers, and an Xbox.
Dee Dee arched a brow at the mention of the gaming system.
Already on it, he assured her.
Pedophiles loved to hide digital files, say, incriminating photos, as attachments to computer games, where the file sizes were already so huge and graphic-rich that it was hard to see the piggyback. Inside stereo speakers was also a favorite spot for stashing thumb drives. In this house, given this crime scene, they couldn't afford to assume anything.
I'll talk to our 3-9-1-1 callers, Dee Dee said, see if I can determine at exactly what time the first shot was fired, then who might have seen something on the street. Given the position of Charlie Boyd's body, shooter had to have come through the front door, meaning we should be able to find a witness.
Or Roxy Baez did it herself, acting alone.
Gonna be a long day, Dee Dee said, and probably an even longer night, Phil agreed.
Phil walked back into the house while Dee Dee squared her shoulders and headed for the noise and chaos of the front street. Eyewitness testimony, with all its inherent strengths and weaknesses, here she came. 63-year-old Mrs. Sanchez had the kind of direct stare and firm voice Dee Dee liked in a witness. Yes, she'd heard shots, was standing at her kitchen sink washing the breakfast dishes when she heard a distinct pop, pop, pop. Not terribly loud, but no mistaking the sound. She'd just set down the plate, was trying to figure out what to do next when she heard more. She'd picked up the phone and dialed 911 immediately. 6 minutes after 9. She'd looked at her watch to note the time. No, she had not heard screaming or sounds of commotion, just the shots and then nothing. She wasn't even sure which place they'd come from. Across the street, she thought. But given the options, an entire row of homes, most of which had been turned into multiple units... Yes, she'd peeked out from her second-story window, but no, she hadn't seen anyone running down the street. In fact, the sidewalks had been quiet for such a sunny morning. Had she heard sounds of arguing or any disturbances earlier in the morning? No, but then she spent most of her time in her kitchen, catching up on chores while watching her shows. Not much she could hear from back there. How well had she known the family across the street? Well enough. Charlie had come over last year when he'd noticed the railing of her front steps was hanging loose. Technically, her landlord was responsible for the repairs, but Charlie had volunteered to fix it himself, given how long landlords could take to get around to such things. He'd brought Manny with him. A chatty little thing. Sweet boy. Mrs. Sanchez had produced some cookies, and after that, Manny had taken to showing up on his own in case she had any more sweets. On nice days, she liked to sit out front, which is how she'd come to know Hector. Manny had dragged his father over for introductions. The younger girl started visiting as well, especially if there was a chance of snacks. The oldest was shy. At least that's what Manny said. Roxanna might wave and nod when out playing with the dogs, but she rarely crossed the street. They seemed like a nice family. And no, Mrs. Sanchez had never noticed strangers coming and going at odd hours or vehicles pulling up for short periods of time before driving quickly away, which already made them much better than the previous owners, the ones who'd lost the house to foreclosure, the ones whom Mrs. Sanchez had reported twice as probable drug dealers. Were they really dead, all of them? Such a waste. Such a terrible, terrible waste. Who would do such a thing? This time, Dee Dee was the one who didn't have the answer. She left Mrs. Sanchez with her card and a request to call if she thought of anything else. Then Dee Dee moved on to the next 911 caller. Mr. Richards lived in the building next to the Boyd Baez family. He'd been in the basement, starting laundry, when he'd heard the shots. At first, he'd thought it was the sound of a car backfiring, but then when he heard it again, he knew immediately it had come from the house next door. By the time he'd run upstairs, though, and peered through the window, he hadn't seen anything. Not on the street, nor in the backyard, which he could see from his third-story unit. What about the dogs? Dee Dee asked. That made him think. Mr. Richards didn't know the family well, but he was used to the sight of the two brown-spotted dogs sleeping on the back porch. Come to think of it, he hadn't seen them that morning. Not that he'd been paying much attention, he added hastily. Had he heard the sound of arguing? Any disturbances? Maybe while he was eating breakfast? His apartment was much closer than Mrs. Sanchez's. Mr. Richards shook his head. He'd been gathering laundry, though, then lugging it all the way down to the basement washer and dryer. The morning had been quiet, just like any other morning, he reported, and then... He shrugged, spread his hands. As witnesses went, he'd heard more than he'd seen, and that was that. Dee Dee thanked him for his time, moved on to caller number 3. Barb Campbell was a 28-year-old English teacher, currently house-sitting her parents' rear apartment on the second floor of the building to the left of Charlie Boyd's fixer-upper. She'd been reading when she'd heard the shots. Close enough, sharp enough, her first instinct had been to duck. It had taken her a few moments to realize the shots had come from the side of her apartment and not out front. She'd belly-crawled over to a window, peering out. Most of her view was obscured by the side of the Boyd Baez residence, but looking diagonally, she could just make out a thin slice of the family's backyard, and a foot disappearing over the rear wooden fence. "What size?" Dee Dee asked immediately. "Male, female, adult, child?" "I don't know, a foot. The sole, mostly. Black? Maybe the bottom of a boot?" "Did it have a heel? Say, fashionable versus functional tread?" I don't know, maybe a tennis shoe? I was pretty rattled. I'd never heard gunshots before, especially that close. I wasn't sure what to do." "How long did you watch?" "Probably several minutes, you know, in case the person came back." "And?" "Nothing." "No sounds of commotion from the residents on the other side of the fence, the property behind the Boyd Baez house?" "It's not a residence. That building is office space. Maybe a dental clinic, real estate, something like that." "What about right before the sound of shots fired? What did you hear then?" Barb Campbell flushed. "I was reading, and I don't exactly hear much when I'm lost in a good book." "Dogs barking?" She shook her head. "Voices arguing, screaming." Another shake. "Had you noticed anything going on earlier at the house? Maybe glanced out while you were pouring a cup of coffee, picking up your novel?"
The dogs. I heard the jangle of their collars as they came around the side yard."
"They were running or playing?"
"No, the girl had them. Looked like she was taking them for a walk."
Dee Dee stared hard at Barb Campbell. "You saw someone leave with the dogs?"
"The taller girl. Long dark hair, maybe 18 or so. She stopped right beneath this window to pick up her backpack."
"Her backpack?"
"Yes, a ratty, light blue thing. Looked like she was retrieving it from behind a bush."
"What time was this?" Dee Dee asked sharply.
"I don't know, maybe 8:30? I was just getting ready to read."
"What was she wearing? Color of her shirt, maybe a jacket?"
I wasn't paying that much attention. Red shirt, maybe?" "I can picture red. And blue jeans, I think. I don't know, nothing special."
Did you see her leave through the front gate?
No, I just saw her walking down the side yard, but she had both dogs on leashes, then she grabbed her backpack. Where else would she go but through the front gate?
Did she seem agitated, upset, anything?
Honestly, I have no idea.
What about a phone? Did she have her cell in her hand? Did you hear her talking to anyone?
Barb Campbell shook her head.
Beatty handed the woman her card, but her mind was already elsewhere.
At 8:30 in the morning, approximately 35 minutes before the shootings, Roxy Baez had left the house with not only the dogs, but also a backpack she'd secreted away.
Filled with items she'd stolen from her family? Supplies she already knew she might need for her future life on the run? The backpack bothered Dee Dee. Seemed to indicate some kind of advanced planning. But what kind of 16-year-old ran away with two dogs? Or worse, exited the property, then returned to shoot the rest of her family to death. What the hell had been going on in this house? Who was this family?
Chapter 6. Name, Roxana Baez, grade 11, teacher, Mrs. Chula. Category, personal narrative. What is the perfect family? Part 1.
When the cops first arrive, my baby brother runs away and hides under the bed. There's a lady with them. She came in her own vehicle, a little economy car. We've seen her before. She walks up to the door first, knocks hard.
Don't answer it, my little sister says.
She is 8, nearly my height, with long, dark hair and big, dark eyes, like a doll. Sometimes when she goes with me to the corner market, grown men stare at her. I don't take her to the corner market as much anymore. I don't have those problems. The lady knocks again. She wears nice pants, black, and a purple-colored blouse. Fancy clothes, I think. But they don't work with her face, which is tightly pinched. Not so nice. She has come to our apartment twice before. We don't think she likes kids. Maybe for her job you can't.
Shh, Lola says. Pretend we're not here.
Being older and wiser, I already know this won't work. The lady will come in. She always has. And now, the policeman standing behind her, waiting. I'm 11. I'm the oldest, and these things are my responsibility. Slowly, I unlock the door. The lady and I stare at each other. This isn't your fault, she says, then pushes by me into the apartment. I try to clean. I try to shop, put together meals, wash clothes. But this latest spell? It has lasted longer than most. I've raided my mother's purse, then the money in the freezer, then the emergency funds she stashes under the mattress and doesn't know that I know about, except I think she got to most of that money first. I think she used those last few dollars for the bottles of tequila that now roll across the apartment floor, which is why the lady has come to the door. She looks around. I already know she sees everything. Last time she asked me about the empty fridge, the dishes in the sink, the stench in the bathroom. So many questions. I did my best. I'm the oldest. That's my job. I tried. Later, my mother yelled at me. She wept. She raged. They will take you away, she cried. Don't you understand? They'll take you away from me. My baby brother got so upset I had to sleep with him that night. The two of us curled up tight on the sofa, Lola on the floor. My mother passed out on the bed. I don't want to go away. Manny sobbed. It's okay, I told him then. We're family. No one is going to tear us apart.
I'm the oldest, which means I'm the one who knows best how to lie.
Where's your mom? The pinch-faced lady asks me now.
You just missed her, I say politely. Beside me, Lola nods. She might be only 8, but we've both heard this question before. From down the hall comes the sound of crying. Poor Manny. Hiding under the bed from the pinch-faced monster. The lady looks toward the bedroom.
Your brother? She asks.
He's little. These visits scare him.
I'm here for his protection.
I don't say anything. She's told me this before. As the saying goes, we agree to disagree on this subject.
Is your mother in the bedroom?
She's out.
Roxy, I know she's home. I can smell the liquor from here.
I look away. There are many things I can fix, many things I can do. Clean this, organize that.
Manny, it's time to shower. Lola, put on fresh clothes. Come on, let's all go to school.
But there are things I can't control. Like my mother,
every time she moans Hector's name and drags out another bottle of booze. This environment is not healthy, the woman says. Lola and I stare at the floor. I'm sorry, Roxy. I know you care. I know you're trying. You're going to have to trust me on this. In the long run, this is what's best for you. The police enter the home then. They push past Lola and me. They head down the hall. A scream, a wail. I don't know what to do. I can hear my mother, drunken, angry, sloppy. Don't you take your hands off, goddamn sons of bitches. Hey, stop, goddamn. Then more screaming, in earnest now, followed by a low curse. Manny comes bursting out of the doorway. I just have time to see blood on his mouth. Under stress, Manny bites. Then he flings himself at me. I catch him, hefting him up, though at four he's getting too big for this. He hugs me tight. I grip him back just as hard. Then Lola throws herself at me, grabbing on as well. I can smell my baby brother. Sweat, tears, goldfish crackers. All I had to feed him for lunch. And I can feel Lola, her strong, too skinny arms squeezing hard. I want to close my eyes. I want to freeze this moment. Me, my brother, my sister. So many nights I've promised to keep them safe. So many mornings I've told them everything will be all right. I don't know what to say anymore. I don't know what to do. The lady is staring at me. This is not your fault, she says again. But I don't believe her, and she knows it. They drag my mom out of the room. One of the officers is listing off charges, violation of this, neglect of that. She is cursing and swearing, wearing nothing but a yellow, stained T-shirt. She turns and vomits. The two cops jump back. She sees her moment and races for the door. The only thing between her and freedom is the solid column of her three children, still entwined. At the last moment, our eyes meet. She stares at me, wild, crazy. For a moment, I think she sees me, actually sees me, because her eyes go sad. Her face looks bleak. Then she slams into us, knocking us down. She shoves aside the pinch-faced lady and rushes ahead. She just gets the door open before the next cop appears on the porch, standing right in front of her. She screams, trapped, enraged, furious. She vomits again. On the floor, Manny cries harder and buries his little face against my shoulder. Then the cop has my mom by the arm. He drags her through the pool of vomit, out of the house, off the porch. He takes her away. And my mother, who once read us stories and sang us songs and made us crazy tacos, is gone. The remaining cops are still swearing softly. One has puke on her shoes. You need to come with me, the lady says. The three of us look up from the floor, but we don't move. I'm sorry. I tried everything. The woman's voice catches slightly. It's very difficult to find one home that can take three kids, she says finally. But I can keep the two of you together. She looks at me and Lola. Manny has a different foster family. It takes me a moment to understand what she's saying. When I do, I can feel my heart hiccup in my chest. Then everything goes cold. I don't. I can't. I hold Manny tighter, even as Lola curls herself up around us. The woman is holding out her hand. The woman is waiting. We don't move. We can't move. One of the cops reluctantly steps forward. Shh, he says gently, and holds out his arms to take my brother away. What is the perfect family? My name is Roxana Baez. I'm 16 years old, and when my teacher first posed this question, said this is what we had to write about, I nearly laughed. There is no such thing, I thought. Why not just have a bunch of high schoolers write about the Tooth Fairy or Santa Claus? But lately I've been giving this a lot of thought. I think a perfect family doesn't just happen. A perfect family has to be made. Mistakes, regret, repair. You have to work at it. This is my family story. Please read on. Chapter 7. I didn't waste any time. After seeing the Amber Alert for Roxana Baez, I immediately called Sarah and arranged to meet at her apartment. She started pacing the minute she let me in, a wild animal barely in control. I closed the door behind me,
paused to lock all three locks, then brought my peace offering to the tiny kitchen table, not saying a word. Sarah had been the sole survivor of a murder spree nearly 2 years ago. Drunken roommate brought home a psychopath from the local bar. Psychopath went after all four girls with a hunting knife. Sarah had made it. The other three had not. The case had garnered nationwide headlines and plenty of attention, including my own. Every snapshot on TV of her pale, shell-shocked face, every reporter shouting some completely ridiculous, too personal question while she continued to stare blindly into the camera, a woman still not sure where she was or how she'd made it out alive. I watched her for a bit, skulking from the shadows, recon for the wounded. Then, I don't know, she reminded me of me, of where I'd been in the beginning. So I'd knocked on her door. Middle of the night, and she'd answered, just as I knew she would, looking like some kind of rabid creature about to burst out of her own skin. We talked. I made her promises I had no idea if I or anyone else could keep. Then she cried, though she kept telling me how much she hated tears. And so it began. My project. Identifying other broken souls. Trying to teach all of us how to live again. A support group for those who'd been to hell and back and were still trying to sort out the change in scenery. Which had just brought me here. Sarah's studio apartment looked better. At my suggestion, make your home a place you can feel safe, she'd painted the walls peach and hung an oversized graphic poster in bright shades of blue, green, and red. The artwork was too busy for my tastes, but she claimed it gave her something to focus on in the middle of the night. Which was the point of our little group, after all, exchanging tricks for chasing the demons away. How well did you know her? I asked now. I removed two cups of Dunkin' Donuts coffee from the carrying tray, heavy on the cream and sugar for both, then opened a box of munchkins. Another tip? There's no problem a lot of caffeine and too much sugar can't handle, though some of the group members preferred hot chocolate to coffee. Whatever. I didn't really know her. Not yet. That's the whole point. Sarah turned. I tossed a jelly munchkin at her head, applauded silently when she caught it. Her reflexes had improved remarkably in the past few months. Start at the beginning, I advised. Another sip of coffee, another donut hole. She was standing outside the studio, where I'd started kickboxing, as you suggested. I nodded. What did you notice? What about her caught your attention? Had you seen her before? Sarah frowned. She stopped pacing long enough to pop the donut bite in her mouth. Another one of the homework assignments I'd given her. Observe. Work on the transition from hypervigilance to due diligence. I don't think I'd seen her before, but she was nervous, skittish, like she was worried about someone seeing her. I studied Sarah over the battered table. She reminded you of you, I said.
Yeah. She looked like she had the weight of the world on her shoulders, and she was staring through the glass at the kickboxers like she wished she could be as tough as that.
What did you say to her?
I asked her if she wanted to come in. She backed away immediately, seemed spooked that I'd noticed her. She started to walk away, and I...
Sarah looked at me.
You said I should trust my instincts. You said instincts are there for our own protection.
I nodded.
She needed help. That was my first instinct.
I didn't say anything.
So, I said I was just leaving, heading to the corner for a cup of coffee. Maybe she'd like to join.
Sarah shrugged.
I didn't think she'd go for it at first. She had on this ratty blue backpack, was clutching the shoulder straps as if her life depended on it. Then, all of a sudden, she relaxed, said, okay. We walked together to the coffee shop.
Where she told you about her friend?
Yes. She had a friend. She was worried about her. Wondered if kickboxing might help make her feel stronger. Sarah shrugged a bony shoulder. I did what you suggested. I didn't try to tell her what she should do. I just talked about me. I told her I'd survived something awful once. So bad I didn't think I'd ever feel safe again. But now I did things like kickboxing, and it made me feel good. Stronger. And once you feel stronger, act stronger, a lot of your problems go away. Bad people don't want to deal with the powerful. They prey on the weak.
What did she say?
Mostly she stared at the table. We hadn't gotten around to ordering the coffee yet, and she kept the backpack on. I figured she'd bolt at any moment. I asked her if she was sleeping at night. She shook her head. I asked her if someone was hurting her now. I mean, a teenage girl. Sarah shrugged. You have to wonder. I nodded. She got nervous, accused me of being a cop. I assured her I wasn't, just someone who's been there. But I had to back off. She was so skittish. I told her she should come back to the studio. The following week there was a beginner's class. Maybe she could check it out. And you told her about our group. I didn't mean to sound accusatory, but maybe I did. I didn't think she'd go to the class. I figured she'd walk out of the coffee shop and that would be that, and I... Sarah floundered, waved her hands. Look, I'm new to this, but you said trust your instincts, and this girl... I felt for her. She seemed terrified. She looked like I did, not that long ago. I nodded. I wasn't really mad at Sarah, and not just because I was the one who had told her to trust her instincts, but because I was also new to this survivor mentoring gig. I just put on a better front. She logged on to the group forum that night. I filled in the rest. Newbies could only access the boards using an established member's password, at which point Roxana Baez had requested permission to join herself, meaning basically I followed back up with the sponsoring member, Sarah, who'd personally vouched for her. The system was hardly rigorous or foolproof. I'd debated it several times, increasing the demands for basic info in the interest of better security versus the risk of scaring off people who were just figuring out how to speak up. In the end, I'd kept it simple, meaning Roxy Baez had joined our group based strictly on Sarah's say-so. I pulled the transcripts from the past few weeks, I continued now, before I deleted the entire forum, went without saying. She didn't post much, just lurked, which also isn't uncommon. Most survivors are naturally distrustful. They have to get the lay of the land before they proceed. I learned early on there are a lot of survivors out there, but only some of us will or can connect. Just the way it is in real life, I guess. Not everyone is meant to understand you, and not just anyone can help you. I glanced at the sheaf of papers. She doesn't talk about her home life. Certainly no mention of a mom, stepdad, two younger siblings, or dogs. She just mentions this friend. She needs help for a friend.
There was no way I could have seen this coming, Sarah said.
No one's blaming you, especially not me. For the first time, her shoulders came down.
What do we do? I've been listening to the Amber Alerts all morning. There's still no sign of her. Do you think someone took her? That's what this is all about? Maybe this person who's hurting her friend caught wind that Roxy was trying to help out and decided to take action?
I have no idea.
Or did she... She couldn't have killed them, right? I mean, why would this girl, Roxana, shoot her entire family? I mean, sure, she asked some questions about guns, self-defense laws, but, you know, if she's looking out for her friend...
What did you tell her?
Some basic safety 101... The bear spray canisters, because they're filled with pepper spray and easy to find at any outdoor store.
Do you know if she bought any bear spray? I asked. For her friend?
No.
Did you have a sense of where she was most afraid? On the home front, or maybe something at school?
Sarah shook her head.
Could this be as simple as some kind of drug thing? I thought out loud. Her family was dealing, or she was feeling pressure from the local thug to join his business?
I don't think so, Sarah hesitated. She didn't seem that type. Roxana was quiet, shy. I don't know. She didn't seem hard enough for that lifestyle. You know, didn't have that thousand-yard stare.
I didn't say anything. Some of the girls I'd met with Jacob, none of them seemed hard enough for that lifestyle, or they shouldn't have been.
She talk about any skills she already had, I asked. Steps she'd taken to help her friend?
Sarah shook her head.
Sorry.
And this friend? She never provided any name, details, school friend, work friend, family friend?
Sarah hesitated.
No. You don't think there's a friend? I filled in.
She shrugged. Classic line, right? I don't need any help, but now that you mention it, I do have a friend.
I nodded. My thoughts exactly. Her family? Any information? Nothing. Like I said, I didn't even know she had siblings or dogs. Flora, what are we going to do?
I sighed, sipped my coffee.
How do you feel right now?
Helpless, sick to my stomach. Do you like that feeling?
No, not at all.
Me neither. So it's settled. No helplessness for us. We're going to work.
How?
Use our skills. Use our heads to locate Roxana Baez. Maybe it's her, or maybe it's her friend, but someone is in trouble, and we're not going to feel better until we figure it out. So let's figure it out.
Sarah stared at me. Like you did with the college student? Meaning put ourselves in danger, Flora?
I wasn't thinking anything that dramatic.
I'm not that strong, Flora. Nothing like that. We use our skills. We use our heads.
It also just so happens I know the detective in charge of this case.
We're going to the police?
We find Roxana Baez. Then we can get the answers to our questions. And then we can sleep at night.
Sarah appeared less convinced, but she finally sat, picked out a fresh donut hole, popped it into her mouth. I'm very sorry about this, she said.
Please, tell that to Roxana Baez.
Chapter 8 Dee Dee found the gun. It was simply a matter of retracing the shooter's path once she knew the person had exited out the back and over the fence for his or her getaway, which brought Dee Dee to the tiny backyard and overgrown herb garden. First, she checked the weed-lined fence. Tossing the murder weapon was a time-honored trick for savvy criminals, or anyone who watched the Godfather movies. Leave the gun, take the cannoli. She came up empty along the fence line, but sure enough, in the herb garden, hastily buried under a tall patch of leggy cilantro, she discovered a cloth-wrapped, snub-nosed .22. Perfect for shooting four people in a crowded urban environment where noise and getaway time would be major factors. The serial number had been ground off, so a burner weapon, most likely picked up on the street by a killer with some smarts. The lab techs would determine just how smart. There were tricks for restoring serial numbers, entire chemical kits designed for just these situations. For now, Dee Dee was more interested in her first impressions. The handgun appeared older, rough around the edges, not a .22 that had been diligently cleaned after each use, then replaced to a gun safe. No, she had pegged this as a street weapon even before noting that the serial number had been erased. Meaning, most likely, the shooter had brought the gun with him, shown up with a plan and proper equipment, which fit the timeline they had thus far. Everything had happened fast. No social call that had escalated to an argument, then shots fired. Just a quick, calm morning. So quiet, so calm. Charlie Boyd had never even gotten off the couch. To Dee Dee, the scene felt less like a domestic gone bad than an execution. But why? What in the world could a family have done to provoke this? Phil appeared on the porch behind her. Wordlessly, she held up the firearm which she'd bagged and tagged. Any luck with the security camera on the property behind us? She nodded to the roof of the three-story office building which towered above the fence line. The building had four cameras, covering front, back, both sides. All were dismantled. She turned, studied Phil. How often does the building super check the cameras?
Every day, meaning the cameras were taken out earlier this morning.
She nodded, her mind now firmly made up. This was a planned event. The gun, the security cameras. This wasn't an impulsive act of rage, but a calculated crime. Any luck with Roxana's cell phone?
Cell company's been pinging away, nothing. But we do have a discovery of sorts. The Brittany Spaniels, Rosie and Blaze... We found them.
The dogs were 10 blocks away, a decent distance given the length of the streets. Both had been tied under a copse of trees near a corner coffee shop. Plenty of shade, Dee Dee noticed when she first approached, and they'd been left with a bowl of water. The dogs raised their heads as she and Phil approached. A uniformed officer was already standing guard, attracting attention as pedestrians tried to figure out why two old dogs required a police escort. The Brittany Spaniels were lying down.
The first one, with a longer, shaggier, white and brown patched coat, wagged her tail at the sound of Dee Dee's approach. She stared up with big brown eyes, whining slightly. Dee Dee held out her hand first, then, when the dog nuzzled her palm in greeting,